Independent Radio Shack Corporation. We are here before the court on our appeal as to the court's grant of summary judgment with respect to liability on a certain lease that was made a significant number of years ago. Radio Shack, as formerly was Tandy Corporation, had guaranteed that lease of performance by the lessee. There's no dispute with respect to the fact that at one time Color Tile went into bankruptcy, and actually it's at that time that the issue of liability under the underlying lease arises. With respect to the fact that the court granted summary judgment in favor of Mrs. Coleman on declaring that she is the successor in interest to the lease that was before the court, that lease actually was a sublease. There's a series of transactions here where you have the top lease between Allstate's Insurance Company and Robert Hall, a sublease between Robert Hall and Parknap Properties, and another sublease by Parknap Properties to Color Tile. That is the lease which is the subject matter of the dispute, and that is the lease in which was the guarantee attached to, and the only lease which the guarantee attached to. During the course of plaintiff's motion for summary judgment, court allowed us to take the deposition of Mr. Owen Coleman, who was the husband of Mrs. Coleman. At that time, and during the time that the motion for summary judgment was in process, certain documents were being produced by the plaintiff in order to meet the arguments raised by the defendant that the plaintiff had not met her burden of proof with respect that she was the successor in interest to Parknap's realties. One of the documents that which was produced was a document which is called or identified as a surrender agreement. It's a document dated in October of 1977, a three-party agreement between the owners of the property, which was Morgan Guaranty Bank, the tenants, and there was a number of tenants involved in this property because Robert Hall was in bankruptcy, and this was a surrender agreement that was being made in that bankruptcy proceeding, and that agreement was subsequently approved by the bankruptcy court. The surrender agreement is a three-part agreement: the landlord, owners, the tenant, which was at that time Robert Hall, and a number of Robert Hall entities, and a number of Robert Hall subtenants. So it's a three-party agreement. Now, with respect to that, the agreement provided that the Morgan and Robert Hall were going to surrender all of the leases back to Morgan. Morgan was going to pay them off, giving them some money, and that the agreement provided that they were going to surrender all of their leases. So the top lease, the prime lease, is now being surrendered. Under principles of law well established in Illinois, when the top lease is surrendered, all subleases that derive from that are also extinguished. A sublessee can have no greater rights than the sublessor, and going on all the way up to the chain. So you have a chain of sublease agreements, sublease interests. Now, in the surrender agreement, which is the main document which was the issue before the court on the summary judgment on liability, the question had to do with whether or not the subtenants, at least the court interpreted, that the subtenants did not relinquish its rights under the surrender agreement. I submit to the court that I believe that the trial court was wrong in its interpretation of the lease with respect to certain paragraphs of the lease, and was wrong in not considering testimonial evidence of Mr. Coleman, where he testified in the deposition with respect to certain condition, and most importantly, the fact that the condition had been fulfilled, the condition having to do with the consent of the subtenant to the cancellation of its lease, as well as all of the leases that it derived from. The portions of the surrender agreement I'd like to bring to the attention of the court is the whereas provisions. The fourth whereas provision and the sixth whereas provision. But the sixth one in particular states that the subtenants are desirous of releasing UMM, that was the parent company of Robert Hall, and the tenants of all obligations under the subleases, provided the condition set forth in paragraph 13 is satisfied. Paragraph 13 says that the subtenants, upon the condition here and after set forth being satisfied, consent to the cancellation of the leases covering the sublease premises, provided that such consent and release by the subtenants shall be and become effective only if prior to the closing, the following condition is satisfied: that the various subtenants and Morgan shall have entered into new leases in respect to each of the premises. Particularly noticeable is the four subtenants are all entities controlled by Mr. Coleman. He has an ownership interest in all of them, 50% with another partner. He is in the business. He's a real estate lawyer in the business of real estate development. He is an extremely experienced man in real estate, as well as extensive real estate investments involving entities throughout the country. What happened is that during the course of the motions for summary judgment and the deposition of Mr. Coleman, Mr. Coleman then produced another document, another lease. That lease is so-called the Parkland Properties lease, one of his other entities. So under the surrender agreement, Parkland Properties was to get a lease. If it consents to the surrender, it was going to get a new lease with Morgan, and therefore a subtenant would then be satisfied and protected. What happened, though, Mr. Coleman had another one of his entities, Parkland Properties, enter into the lease with Morgan. The Parkland Properties lease was November of 1977 and had a termination date of 1992, which is important because Color Tag was into bankruptcy in 1996. So if there's a claim with respect to that the plaintiff is a successor in interest to Parkland Realty, that is not valid because that lease would have expired in 1992. Going on, but more importantly, is the fact that Mr. Coleman testified with respect to the Parkland lease being the lease that satisfied the condition in paragraph 13 throughout his deposition testimony, and repeatedly I covered that point to make sure that he was not making a mistake with respect to that. And he said the condition had been fulfilled. Once the condition is fulfilled, the conditional consent, the condition is removed, he consents to the termination and surrender of the prior leases, including his lease, and all leasehold interests derived from the initial lease are eliminated and wiped away. That's fundamental Illinois law, well established, and that's where we're at today. The judge, Judge Connelly, said he did not view it, he did not interpret that way, the agreement that way. It also appears from the record, when we filed a motion for reconsideration, when we tried to raise with him again the testimony of Mr. Coleman, it appears that, based upon the comments, although I'm not sure completely, that the court did not consider the testimony of Mr. Coleman. And I submit to the court that that was error. And it was error in the context that testimony with respect to what follows up, whether a condition is fulfilled or unfulfilled, whether or not there's been a subsequent modification of an agreement, either orally or by conduct, is admissible evidence, does not violate the parole evidence rule. The second part of our appeal, let me finish with respect to that. If we are right and the judge is wrong, the low court is wrong, the underlying lease between ParkNet Properties and Color Tile is eliminated by operation of law. Candy's guarantee that is based upon that would also be terminated and ended. As between the lessor and lessee, they would have a completely different relationship, maybe a tenancy at law. I'm not quite sure because that's what the law appears to be as between them. But that would not be a tenancy based upon a leasehold interest or a contract. There is no contract, subcontract, between ParkNet Properties and Parkman Properties. The lease with ParkNet Properties and Color Tile is out in Rice Field, unattached. It has no interest, no leanhold interest going up to any lease above. And it has no leasehold interest that would be derived from Parkman. Therefore, the agreement is extinguished. Liability then would be extinguished, and the relationship between landlord and tenant would be whatever they want it to be. With respect to the second part of the argument, that the trial court made errors with respect to errors of law with respect to interpretation of the lease provisions with respect to repair damages. The court made decisions with respect to repair damages as being that they were initially in the summary judgment. The summary judgment motion dealt with that, and he says they're not entitled to damages, repair damages, under Section 501 of the lease, because the court found that they were major improvements to the property made at the end of the Color Tile lease for the purpose of enhancing the property for the new tenant. not repairs because they were replacement of the roof, replacement of the parking lot, and replacement of the HVAC. In addition, we argued that those were capital improvements that were capitalized as expenses under the plaintiff's tax return would not be able to be then assessed over to a tenant and then onto the guarantor. With respect to some of the repairs themselves, we submitted to the court that there was no evidence that there was any inspection of the premises by the owner of the property at the time of Color Tile's surrender of the lease. That lease was possession was surrendered in January of 96. And it was clear and undisputed that the plaintiff and its managing agent, Wynn Properties, also owned by Mr. Coleman, never inspected the premises for over 25 years. It was not their operating procedure, standard practice to do so. And the premise laid vacant for 2.5 years while their efforts were being made to relet the premises, and that's another issue on appeal that was part of the issue raised by the defendant. So for 2.5 years, the property remains vacant. No major repairs are made. Nothing is done. No inspection. And then there's an attempt to pass off these repairs onto us. The trial court rendered a memorandum opinion on summary judgment, said that they're not entitled to that under the lease provision, section 501. However, they may be able to argue and establish it as a cost of mitigation. It was based upon that ruling of the court, and the court said that issue will now be raised in the mitigations proceeding of the court. I anticipated that the case on mitigation would cover reasonable efforts to mitigate damages as well as the repairs, whether they would be construed as a mitigation damage. So we had extensive testimony with respect to that, and when the judge's findings of fact came out, conclusions of law, the trial court made a determination that these were not mitigation expenses, but then reversed itself and said that they're available under section 501 of the lease, which we contend is not completely erroneous because he had ruled earlier that it had not been. We also argue that the repair expenses were capitalized by the plaintiff on her tax returns, and the evidence on that was clear, and that as a matter of law, that should also preclude them from being assessed over to the defendant. With respect to certain other, and we also said as a matter of law, Illinois law is perfectly clear that in order to establish a claim for repairs against a defaulting tenant, you must show the condition of the lease at the time of the tenancy and the condition of the premises at its conclusion in order to make a comparison as to whether or not these repairs or non-repairs are due to the defaulting tenant. That was not done. There is no dispute that there was no inspection of the premises. 2 years, 2.5 years later, they bring in a heating contractor and a paving contractor. 2.5 years in which the plaintiff has had possession of the premises. And then they attempt to assert that was the condition of the premises at the time of surrender. There's no nexus to that. With respect to the HVAC, there's an additional particular problem with respect to the HVAC replacement. The HVAC contractor did not testify. There was no testimony from the HVAC contractor as to the necessity for the replacement of the HVAC. The HVAC contractor was an entity called Slanker. I don't know where the court got its rulings with respect to, or its finding of fact with respect to the disrepair of the HVAC. The HVAC contractor never testified, and the only testimony with respect to that was a witness by the name of Mary Deliveriziaga, and she never was out to the premises at all. It appears that the court based its decision on an affidavit that Mr. Slanker had submitted in the motion for summary judgment, but Mr. Slanker did not testify at the trial. And I submit to the court that there is no foundation for that. There's no evidence to support that conclusion. With respect to the repairs of the roof and the parking lot, the roof in particular, the witness testified, the contractor testified, that the roof had been repaired. There were patches on the roof. And if anyone who's owned any property in the city of Chicago, you do place attachments over the roof, and you relayer the roof over the life of the building. There is undisputed testimony by the owner as well that that was, had been done, and the contractor testified it too. But what he said was the building had worn out. The roof had worn out. The trial court converted that into a duty to repair. I mean, to replace. There is no duty to replace under Section 501, only the duty to repair. And the court construed that as saying that converts, you should have done this. Well, the lease does not require that. And that was a major capital improvement solely for the benefit of the landlord, and therefore it should not have been assessed over against the...
You want to save some time for a vote?
Yes, please.
Very good. Thank you. So, Mr. Michigan?
May it please the court. My name is Sidney Michigan. It's my privilege to speak to the court on behalf of Mrs. Coleman, who is the happily cross appellant in this case. The bankruptcy agreement had absolutely no effect on the sub-sublease between Parkman Properties and Color Tile by its express terms. It is true that an affiliate of Parknet, Parkman, took the place of Robert Hall in the chain, but by the express terms of the bankruptcy agreement, and the agreement is not, as perhaps the suggestion was made, entitled surrender agreement. I believe it's simply entitled agreement, and it was in the bankruptcy court. The district court properly construed this agreement in accordance with Illinois law by looking at the four corners of the document without resort to extraneous evidence or testimony. There was never, and there is not today, a claim that this agreement was ambiguous. That claim was never made in the trial court. It's not being made here today. What is being said as of yesterday is that the parole evidence rule, which permits evidence of agreements subsequent to a written agreement, is somehow applicable here. But we submit, judges, that that is not the case. We have a written agreement. The evidence that is sought to be introduced, which is extraneous and which is in violation of the parole evidence rule because we do not have an ambiguous agreement, is testimony of Mr. Irwin Coleman when, 23 years after the fact, he attempted to recollect his understanding of the bankruptcy agreement. That agreement was a written document, and it was not ambiguous, and therefore extraneous evidence under Illinois law was not admissible. And indeed, this parole evidence argument that they're making now, this subsequent agreement evidence, was never made in the district court and certainly cannot be made here for the first time on appeal. If we look at the bankruptcy agreement, we will see that there are two very significant paragraphs. The first is paragraph 2, and that says that possession of the subleased premises is going to go back to Morgan from Robert Hall so that Morgan can make a new lease with somebody subject to the rights of the subtenants. Under Illinois law, the district court correctly found that subject to is a very powerful phrase. Under Illinois law, this phrase means subordinate to, subservient to, limited by, which means that any new lease between Morgan and the party who took the place of Robert Hall in the chain was subordinate to, subservient to, and limited by the rights of Parknet and Colorton under the lease that existed between them. And Tandy has cited no case, and we certainly know of none, where any court has said subject to does not mean subject to and should be somehow ignored. Tandy claims, without citation of authority applicable to the facts of this case, that when Park Van entered into the lease with Morgan and took the place of Robert Hall in the chain, that somehow Parknet surrendered, abandoned, and consented to termination of its sub-sublease with Color Tile. Paragraph 13 was first discussed, I believe, by Tandy in its reply brief, and then was not discussed in full. When that document is read, the court will see that the first paragraph says that the consent to this transaction is conditioned upon the various subtenants, of which Parknat was one, entering into a new sublease with Morgan on terms and conditions satisfactory to both. The second portion of that paragraph says that if such a sublease was not entered into, the subtenants reserved all of their rights at law and in equity, and there was no effective consent. And that will appear at Record Document 73, and we invite the court to please read the document.
Does Mr. Coleman's interest in Park Van and Park Nat, they're both 50% interest, is that it?
Yes, Your Honor. The subtenants were all affiliates.
Who are the other, in those entities, who are the other partners?
Well, I believe the evidence was there was a person named Sandelman.
In which, Park Van?
All of them.
Oh, in all of them?
All of them. And Mr. Coleman was the president of all of them.
So, what difference, as far as, describe to me the difference between Park Nat and Park Van. I mean, I understand they're separate entities. Was there any individuals, I mean, how would they chart out? Would it be exactly the same?
Both corporations, and they chart out exactly the same, and, some own some properties and some own some others, and the decision was simply made to have Park Van take the place of Robert Hall in this chain and to leave Park Nat where it was.
They're both in existence then, Park Van.
At the time, yes, sir.
They weren't created for this particular...
That is correct. That is correct. And as the bankruptcy agreement specifically says, that the Morgan Park Van lease is subject to the Park Nat Keller Tollies, there was absolutely no problem. In fact, nothing changed between 1977, when the bankruptcy agreement was entered into, and 1996, when Color Tile went bankrupt. Color Tile exercised an option to renew with ParkNat, paid rent to ParkNat. In fact, Color Tile entered into its own sublease with TJ's Restaurant. And there was nothing here that could possibly release Tandy from its guarantee. Now, as far as the damages the court awarded, there's no question about the fact that Tandy's argument is basically a quarrel with the evidence and the district court's review of that evidence, and that argument cannot succeed in this court. The district court credited and relied upon our roofing expert, our parking lot expert, and Exhibit 86, which dealt with the HVAC.
Yes, and can you speak to that? Because counsel said there was very little evidence. In fact, he said that primarily the district court relied on the affidavit that was submitted in summary judgment. What additional evidence was there from your statement?
Well, counsel was mistaken. There is no reference to any affidavit in the findings, and in fact, the findings specifically are based on Exhibit 86, which came into evidence without objection and which said that the HVAC was beyond repair and had not been serviced or repaired in any way for 3 to 5 years. And I think, Judge, when you look at the findings again, you will see that's the basis of them. There was no reference to anybody's affidavit. We also hear the argument being made that a tenant cannot be required to make capital improvements and that an agreement to repair is not an agreement to replace. The cases that Tandy cites do not support that view and, in fact, go the other way. Sandelman is one of those cases. Unlike our lease, there was only a general covenant of repair. There was nothing said, as our lease says, about repair of the roof and repair of structural. In addition, unlike our case, where there was an inspection made at the beginning of the lease and Tandy set forth in the lease, I'm sorry, Color Tile set forth in the lease that the premises were in fully satisfactory condition, there was nothing like that in Tandem. In the Handy Andy case, we had a situation where when the tenant took possession, the roof was already damaged. And the court said there's nothing in this lease that makes the tenant liable for pre-existing damage. As far as capital improvements are concerned, Andover Togs holds just the opposite of what Tandy would have this court believe. In that case, the court said, sure you can recover capital expenditures. Sure you can recover for capital improvements. What you can't cover for is betterments to the premises. And by betterments, we mean more square footage than we had before. HVAC, where we did not have it before. Restrooms, where we did not have them before. Corridors, which enable you to lease more premises than you were able to lease before. Those are premises. Those are betterments. But certainly capital improvements are recoverable. And confirming that point, Judge Zagel in the Greenberger case held that a tenant can be held liable for capital improvements when it is the tenant's neglect that makes those capital improvements necessary. And that's precisely what Judge Cannelli said in this case. This is a triple net lease, which meant, under the undisputed evidence in this case, that the tenant was responsible for all of the repairs and replacement.
What about the time it took from the, your client, I think it was trying to negotiate a new lease, about a year and a half, with a bad roof? Wouldn't that cause additional damage?
There's no evidence of that, Your Honor. None at all. In fact, the evidence is that this roof was in horrible condition for some 3 to 5 years before Color Tile terminated its lease.
Would the tenant generally be liable, though, for the time it took the landlord to find a new lessee to make the improvements and include them in there?
If Your Honor is speaking about the rent, that would depend on the lease. The repairs for which this tenant was held liable were those which accrued as of and should have been made as of February of 1996 when the tenant vacated. The court did not hold Color Tile liable for any repairs that should have been made after February of 1996. The decision is very clear on that point. This is Color Tile's foreign lease, undisputed evidence, and there's absolutely no evidence that Color Tile ever made that first request that the landlord make any repairs or replacements. And Your Honors can be well satisfied that if the landlord had any such responsibility during the term, given the deplorable condition of the roof and the HVAC in the parking lot, such a request would have been made. There's also been some suggestion in the brief about a double recovery, and of course that's a very catchy phrase, and no one wants to have a double recovery. But the fact is that there could be no double recovery unless tax returns were filed, which should be amended after Tandy pays what we hope this court is going to order Tandy to pay. While we are appellees, we are also cross appellants, and we believe that the decision of the district court that this property should have been released in 8.5 months was clearly erroneous. And we certainly understand the burden that we bear in that regard. We think there are a number of cases of this court, such as Carr against the Allison Division of General Motors, which are instructive on the standard that is to be applied here. In that case, this court reversed findings that a sexual harassment plaintiff had invited the sexual harassment. The court said that the clear error standard does not impose an insuperable burden on an appellant, and that while the review is deferential, it is not abject. And the court went on to say that the standard is applied like this. It's the difference between thinking that had we been the triers of fact, we would have decided the case in a certain way, and being firmly convinced that we would have. The question before the district court was whether the landlord took reasonable measures to mitigate its damages. This case and this kind of question come up all the time. And this court has said this in a related area, reasonable attorney's fees. This court has said, look, in Balcor and Medcom, if the client paid these fees in the ordinary course of business before there was an order for reimbursement, they're reasonable. So what is reasonable should be judged by what works in the ordinary course in the marketplace. Now, the undisputed evidence here is that this Downers Grove property was one of a portfolio of more than 200 properties being managed coast to coast by Wynn Properties for the Coleman family. Wynn followed exactly the same procedures with respect to this property that it followed with respect to any other property that would have come back, whether it be as a result of a defaulting tenant or otherwise. And there was certainly no effort made to do anything that would leave Tandy holding a bill, because the evidence is undisputed that it was not even discovered until December of 1997, almost 2 years after Color Tile's bankruptcy, that there was a 1974 Tandy guarantee. The Illinois cases on the mitigation statute only require that the landlord exercise reasonable care and ordinary diligence. He is not required to incur undue expense, and the reasonableness of his actions is to be judged in the light of the events as they were unfolding at the time, and not on the basis of hypercritical Monday morning quarterbacking.
Well, the court seems to suggest that Coleman Interest took a great deal of time to market this, or hire an agent, local real estate agent. Are those the kind of findings you would say that we could find clear error in?
Your Honor, I do, and the reason is this. The undisputed testimony was that 2.5 months to contract with a broker was not unreasonable, and the evidence is that the first draft of contract went out from Chicago on March 19, and the final version was signed by the broker on May 31. Now, there was a delay in getting the signature of Wynn for a couple of weeks because, under the evidence, they were in the process of moving offices, but that's 2.5 months. The major problem that I think the district court had, and perhaps this was our fault, we didn't do as good a job as we had hoped we would do in showing the district court why the district court had to take into account effective rates. Because the district court was looking at gross rentals as opposed to net rentals. And what happened is this. Color Tile was paying $9.85 per square foot triple net. The court was looking at the gross rentals without regard to what we were going to have to spend to put these premises in condition so that we could find a tenant. And we have set forth at pages 12 to 14 of our brief the calculations, the very calculations that we presented to the district court in final argument. I think there was some statement made that we didn't raise this argument below. We certainly did. The final argument begins at page 996 of the transcript, and we certainly made this point. And one example of what we're talking about is this. A prospective tenant came to us and said, we will pay you $14 a square foot. A very handsome sum. But when we did what they were asking us to do, the effective rate was $9.32, and that's the figure that has to be compared to the Color Tile rate.
So you're suggesting, Ms. Michigan, they would have had to take an actual lower rate. Is that it?
Sir?
You're suggesting then you would have had to take a lower rate?
I'm saying the effective rate would have been absolutely lower, because if someone is paying you 14 and you were spending in excess of 5...
No, I understand, but in the $9 range, you're saying it's a lower $9 figure, right?
Yes, sir. In fact, when you look at the figures per prospective tenant, we were very much in the ballpark of the Color Tile $9.85. Very, very much in the ballpark. There was also fault found because we did not vanilla box. Well, I see my time is up.
Well, you may finish that one.
Thank you. I appreciate that. The undisputed evidence was this. There, as is the case in so many endeavors, there are two schools of thought on vanilla boxing. Some professionals say do it before you have a tenant in hand. Others say wait till you have a tenant in hand and do it as a part of the other lease negotiations. And we simply did there what we always do, which is to do these vanilla boxing and other improvements as a part of the lease negotiations. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Mr. Michigan. Mr. Savalas.
With respect to the claim that the trial court or the argument that is raised that there was a comparison of gross rentals versus net rentals, there was no evidence or testimony adduced with respect to that claim. That is a claim that is made In the appellate brief that was filed with the court, there are no references to the record with respect to that. There's no reference with respect to testimony with respect to that. No finding with respect to that by the trial court, because there wasn't any. That is an argument that is now being raised and asserted. The trial court's finding on mitigation or failure to mitigate damages was based on a multitude of items. The hiring of the broker took 4 months, over 4 to 5 months. The police premises, Your Honor, Justice Wood, 2.5 years. During that time, they had the broker, Peters, bringing in prospective tenants, making proposals of rent that were rejected by the landlord, by Wynn Properties. Mr. Coleman's son was in charge of Wynn. The instructions to Peters to market the premises was, it's in an unimproved condition, either improve it, clean it up. And this is basic stuff when they're talking about Vanilla Box. Vanilla Box is cleaning up the walls, painting them, but no major improvements, enhancing the attractability as to a tenant coming in, looking to see what he can do with that property. At the minimum, their broker, Peter, said, our expert witness, Palifka, said also. There's no dispute with that. The problem with the plaintiff's case is that its own broker doesn't back him up. Its own broker said, unimproved, $8 to $10 per square foot, possibly, I'm sorry, improved eight to 12, unimproved 8 to 10. So what does Wynn Property tell them? Lease it, offer it at $12 per square foot in an unimproved as-is condition. And thereafter that, continuously, prospective tenants were coming forth, making proposals of rent that were above the $985 per square foot that Color Tile was paying, but they were rejecting them. There were disputes with respect to the prospective tenants saying, we don't want to pay for the improvement to clean this place up. The landlord should do that. That's a reasonable expense. No. Wynn said, you do it. 2.5 years. Nevada Bob, according to the testimony, would have taken that lease over in September of 96, 8 months. But they were so turned off by the hard bargaining that was in this record that they went elsewhere and rented for $11, which was the price that they were offering to rent for this place. The broker told them, if you don't put it up, and repeatedly warned them, we're not getting any interest because you're not improving the Vanilla Box. They had estimates from Schlanker to put this place in a Vanilla Box condition. They didn't do it. They had these estimates in 96. They didn't do any of this in 96. They didn't do any of it in 97. In 1998, only when they got a new tenant. Council says that's the regular course of doing business. That is not recognized as a basis under Illinois case law. Illinois case law, in fact, general rule on mitigation of damages, no matter what case it is that the plaintiff has to exercise reasonable efforts to minimize damages. Reasonable efforts in the context of the Illinois mitigation statute places the burden on the landlord to take affirmative action to relet as quickly as possible to minimize the damages to the faulting lessee. That was not done. There are findings galore made by the trial court with respect to that.
Right. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.